seated. Good morning. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. This is our last case to argue this morning. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and to my left is Justice Brian Walker, and I'm Bonnie Setters, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we get started, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case. You may begin. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good mid-morning to y'all. Let me start out by thanking you for the opportunity to argue this case. It kind of presents some interesting legal analysis of issues that I think will be bright and shiny in the Court of Criminal Appeals at some point soon in the future. So I always love discussing these issues. I have 5 points. Obviously, I won't get to all of them, so I really would like to ask the court if there's a place they would like me to start as far as issues go. If there's a particular issue somebody's more interested in. No? Okay, let's just start from the beginning then. Point number one, the culpable mental state issue in this particular case. The Continuous Sexual Abuse Act, which I'll refer to as CSA from now on out, does not in and of itself have a mental state applied to it. This court's never addressed this particular issue. The Court of Criminal Appeals has not addressed this particular issue, but other courts have. And to my detriment, they have found that it's not required that the general CSA contain a mens rea, an intentional or unknowingly, a mental component, because the underlying offenses that are alleged under the umbrella statute do contain a mental element. It's my argument that this court obviously needs to address this issue because it's new. And secondly, I'm asking the court to address it in a different way than the other courts have addressed it, and that is finding that it's not required based on that, based on the underlying offense mens reas. 3 reasons I request that in this particular case. One, 6.02 requires that any offense is not an offense under our codes or laws unless there is a culpable mental state attached. And it's such a strong statute under 602 that if there's not a mental state, they say not only is it not an offense, one shall be attached and written into that statute in application under our Code of Criminal Procedure. So for that reason, my argument is the CSA needs to have, under the umbrella part, a mental state required under our law and to comport with all notions of justice, in my opinion, in this statute, particularly given the gravamen of this offense, which is a 25-year minimum without the possibility of parole just on a first offense conviction. The serious nature of it, I believe, requires a very strict application and scrutiny in application in our courts because it's so serious. Due process, all of the
So would you have the defendant intentionally, knowingly engage in these crimes for more than 30, for a period of 30 days or more? I mean, is that the mental state you would say? So that
correct.
So that when this criminal is committing these crimes, they are saying, I'm going to do this for more than 30 days?
At the time, yes, that they know that they're doing it for more than 30 days. I would say that, but really, we don't reach that question. The question is the statute constitutional as it is?
Mm-hmm.
It can't be, from my belief and my argument, without a mental state and an application with it. I just don't, under 602, it has to be applied. So the trial courts would have to do that if this court were to find that it has to be applied under 602, or the statute's just not constitutional when we have no mens rea, which I think we can all agree is an absolute fundamental part of an essential element of any criminal conduct.
And you just reject the idea that the mens rea is part of the underlying offenses that comprise the crime.
I think it needs to be more, but then that gets to my second reason that in this particular case, because there was no mens rea of the underlying offenses in the application paragraph of the charge in this particular case, it makes it even worse. That the fact that we have no mens rea on the CSA umbrella, and then we have no intentionally or knowingly said in the application paragraph. It was said in the generalized definitions, but as we know, the application paragraph is the heart and soul. It's what the lawyers all refer to in closing arguments. This is what you look at to see where you apply the law to the facts to convict. Did he then and there intentionally or knowingly on such and such a day? Problem in this case is for the sexual assault, there was no intentionally or knowingly in application stated at all. And then in the fondling count, which was a second issue, second count in there, not count, second part of the umbrella of the CSA, the intent to arouse and gratify was not there, which makes them not offenses, particularly on a decency case. People can accidentally touch things that they're not supposed to touch necessarily, and it's not an offense and it's not a crime unless it's with the intent to arouse and gratify. And so all of that was missing in this application paragraph, which makes it more of a necessity that we have to have some mens rea to convict somebody of an offense that holds a minimum of 25 flat without parole in the penitentiary. And in this particular case, the jury didn't have a vehicle to find any mens rea at all in the general umbrella and in the two utilized underneath to convict this man and give him 50 flat years.
Ms. Mullen, I apologize. I've had 4 oral arguments today that I had to get ready for.
Yes.
I may not remember, but did they object to the application paragraph or did they not?
No.
They did not, correct?
Correct.
That's what I thought. Is your position, though, that it's so fundamental that it's egregious that there's no objection that's required? You don't.
Well, yeah. I would certainly prefer an objection.
Yeah.
I think an objection is required, but it did not happen, and so I am arguing egregious harm from this because I don't see how we can avoid that when we have no mental state in the conviction of a criminal charge of this magnitude. I find it hard to believe that when we don't have one essential element in the charging paragraph of a mental state, that conviction can stand. So yes, I'm arguing egregious harm. If there's no other questions on that one, I'm gonna go to the second one, the 30 days in duration. This is yet another issue that some other courts have weighed in on. I don't believe this court's weighed in on it exactly, concerning the fact that these have to happen 30 days apart. There is another case from another court of appeals that have said that a charge that's very similar to this charge misled the jury. And really the point is, this particular charge stated that during a period that was 30 or more days in duration, comma, on or about dates from 2012 to 2017, did commit 2 or more acts. It's my belief, and in line with the Lane case, the other case that said that, I may have said that case name wrong, but it's in my brief, that misstates the law. That a juror could have read that saying during a period that was 30 or more days in duration, comma, on or about 2012 to 2017, well, there's your 30 or more days in duration, the years, right? It's not explicit, and it's not clear to the jury that those two offenses, at least, had to be 30 days apart. And so it was misleading in the added language that they added in the application paragraph when it says the 2-year period or 3-year period.
But doesn't the state argue that it tracks the statute and therefore it can't be error?
It does track the statute in regards to during a period that was 30 days apart or in duration, but the statute does not have the comma, and then they give them the 5-year window. That's what I'm saying. When you add that grammatical addition, you're now making it very unclear and not requiring a conviction if those two events occurred less than 30 days apart. So in other words, when it's phrased like this, during a period that was 30 days or more in duration, on or about 2012 to 2017, 2 or more acts. So on the first day, could have been one act. On the second day, could have been another act. And that was not outside the 30-day window. Correct? By the language that's given, it changes, and the grammatical addition changes such that it actually negates the true gravamen of this offense, which is that 30 days. I mean, if we're going to say that that's what triggers this mega statute on punishment, then that certainly has to be very explicitly stated in a jury charge. We can't have We can't have any misinterpretations of what we mean by that 30 days, that it has to be outside the 30-day window.
But the evidence really doesn't support your position, does it? Because didn't the evidence in this case, or at least the contention was that this occurred for a long period of time on hundreds of occasions?
That would have been her allegation, yes.
And so if that's the case, it would have, by necessity, have had to have occurred in excess of 30 days, because you don't have 100 days in a month. I mean, you don't have 100 or 200 instances in a month.
Correct. Except for a jury needs to understand that that's a requisite of the law, because a lot of times when you have a complainant that testifies, they'll testify about specific events that occurred, and then they'll be, that occurred all the time. And I do believe jurors look at the specific events where the memories are in order to discern whether or not to convict. And so they have to still believe that those specific events occurred within, outside that 30-day window. So I do think the point's well taken that she did say hundreds of times over a long period of time. There was no real time frame given as far as when certain dates, summer, you know, school time. None of that, all of that was very gray. But I still believe there were certain events she talked about, and there's no way a jury could give life or effectuate the 30-day rule, basically, by this the way this charge was written.
And this is another instance where the objection was not made at trial.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Other thing I'd like to point out is the pattern jury charge does discern a way to appropriately give this charge. Another court of appeals, in my belief, I think the state in their brief disagrees with my interpretation, so I'll let that.
But that wasn't pointed out to the trial judge.
No.
That the pattern jury charge. Okay.
But they do talk about you must agree 30 days pass between the first and the last. So that's the way that we can do it without coming into these grammatical problems that negate the gravamen of the CSA. My third point, which is, this court's probably very tired of hearing because you've already decided this issue. It's the Ramos case that came down. It's the issue requiring unanimity. What's interesting, I think, in this particular case, how it all kind of meshes, is that when you've got application, let me stop there and go back. Ramos, as this court's well aware of, has decided the Sixth Amendment unanimity requirement is going to apply to the states. They've been beating that drum for a while. I don't think that we're hearing it in the court system, personally. That's just my personal opinion. I think they're trying to tell us when they overrule all these cases and say their statute on conviction in these states is absolutely unconstitutional, and so you can't get a conviction on those unless than a unanimous verdict. I think they're kind of talking very loudly to everybody, and I feel like things may change because of that. I think unanimity is going to be required, and so I'm asking the court in point three to reassess that situation, because as we know, this court has said, other courts have said, the Court of Criminal Appeals has not said yet, that the CSA does not require, per the statute itself, on the face of the statute, unanimity as to which sexual conducts they're going to find guilt on. Although it goes against every grain that I have as far as unanimity, that is the state of the law. I do feel like Ramos changed that. I think that the Supreme Court is saying you better relook at this, and that with Richardson, with the federal statutes that are similar to this, I think that's going to require unanimity as to these underlying offenses. And so I'd ask the court to relook at that in this particular case. It also has a very interesting complexion, because if we're not going to require unanimity on the individual states, then the mental state, then we're not. And in this particular case, we don't have any mens rea in the charging paragraph, so there's no unanimity either as to the mens rea. So I think in this case, it takes an even more important position of concern. Point four, the SANE report. Everybody's gotten into the position recently, I've noticed in trial, of believing that the SANE report, the nurse's report, sexual assault exam report, is admissible in and of itself wholly for purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment. And by the way, that last point, the Ramos point, that was an objection. So that was good. The same report, there was objections as well as they were hearsay. However, there was no sexual findings in the case. So I don't know how we're getting in any of this evidence concerning the same, but that wasn't objected to, so I digress. The point is, they offered him for medical diagnosis the whole report, and then when the judge, when the defense objected, he hesitated, so then they went to a business record exception. And I've laid out in my brief how neither one of those applied to a lot of the issues that were in the same report.
Ms. Mullen, if yes. I may, you're saying this was objected to, but I believe the state responded that it was a general objection. Obviously, when you have a report, there's always the potential argument to say there's hearsay within hearsay, or some portions of the document aren't hearsay, but some are. Is that correct? It was just a general hearsay. It wasn't.
I think it got a little bit more specific than just that. My time's out. May I just have a second?
Sure.
I think it was just a little bit more specific. It wasn't as specific as I would be or I would want it to be. The objection was made. He did point out that what somebody said, I think what the victim says, what the mom says, is hearsay outside of court. And then they offered business records, and then he reiterated that. He did not go into specific detail as line by line. Thank you.
My name is Joshua Llewellyn, and I represent the state. I only intend to address appellant's first three points, unless the court has questions about some of the other questions or the other points. I can address those as well. As for the first issue, as Ms. Mullen stated, she has the two distinct arguments in her first point of error. The first one was a general CSA mental culpability requirement, and as she concedes, four courts of appeals in this state have already held that no mens rea requirement should be added. I think that the reasoning in those cases is compelling, particularly in Buxton versus State and Lane versus State are the primary published cases on that issue. Appellant also, or Ms. Mullen also mentioned an issue about the statute not being constitutional. I'm not sure I really saw that argument in her brief, and I'm not aware of any authority that would say that the jury not having to require a general mental culpability in a CSA case violates the Constitution in any way. As for her second argument in the first point, the omission of mental culpability requirements in the application paragraph, I'd simply say that terms and offenses adequately defined in the abstract portion of the jury charge don't need to be redefined in the application portion of the jury charge. The Court of Criminal Appeals said it best in Vasquez v. State, a general reference in the application paragraph is sufficient and is not error when the defendant does not object. Here, the application or the abstract portion of the jury charge adequately defined all of the underlying offenses in continuous sex abuse of a child, including indecency, including aggravated sexual assault, and also included those mens rea requirements in that definition. Since it specifically references those underlying offenses, the jury, all they needed to do was look back. It was as the language goes from the Court of Criminal Appeals, it was a necessary and an unambiguous reference. The appellant makes a big deal about how the jury charges, the application paragraph of the jury charge is the heart and soul of the jury charge, and that's what authorizes the conviction. The problem with that type of language is that the language she cites in some cases, it's really a relic of old law that basically when the courts were analyzing sufficiency of the evidence issues under the standard of what the jury was charged, the law that the jury was charged. That was the law of the case, so that's what they had to find. Of course, as we know, the Court of Criminal Appeals has reversed course on that and now judges sufficiency of the evidence on the hypothetically correct jury charge. In fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals has stated, since they changed that doctrine, it may well be that application paragraphs are an anachronism and that jurors could perform just as well without them. So in this case, although the application paragraph didn't outline everything, it did specifically reference those offenses, and they had to find that intent was there for the underlying offenses. Now, as for appellant's argument about unanimity not being required for the mens rea of continuous sex abuse of a child, the problem with that argument is it's one that's been expressly rejected by the Supreme Court of the United States in Shad versus Arizona. In that case, the court was looking at in Arizona statute, which was essentially what we have. It's a version of their capital murder. So it was a very serious offense, even more serious than continuous sex abuse of a child. And there they found that not requiring unanimity as to whether it was intentional murder or felony murder was okay. So they had a whole discussion in that case about whether the jury had to be unanimous about whether there was intent or whether the underlying felony for felony murder satisfied the intent requirement. And they said those two are morally and conceptually equivalent, and therefore it doesn't violate due process. With that, I'll go to harm.
But is that really what's going on in this statute, that they're equivalent? Because indecency is not equivalent to aggravated sexual assault.
I believe in the context of this case, when we're talking about a morally and conceptually equivalent offense, they are, in a sense, morally and conceptually equivalent in that they both involve sexual abuse of a child. Although they're not the exact same type of offense, and they carry different weights and different punishments, for the purpose of the jury unanimity issue, which I'll get to in point three, they are morally and conceptually equivalent. And that has been found by courts of appeals in this state.
And is the case that you're citing, the Supreme Court case, it's pertaining to a mental state situation, right? It's not the actual manner and means or actus reus component. It's just talking about the mental state, isn't it?
And they do talk specifically about the mental state requirement, and they talk about that at length. As far as the specific manner and means, the difference when you're talking about a felony murder versus premeditated murder is, yes, some of the actus rea are going to be different, because one involves, I think in that case it was robbery, murder and during the commission of a robbery, and the other one was simply intentional premeditated murder. So some other actus rea requirements would be there for felony murder that wouldn't be there in the premeditated murder, I guess. As far as harm is concerned, in the first point of error, mental culpability was simply not an issue in this case. The nature of the offenses that were testified about by the victim, I think it would have been unreasonable for a juror to find that the defendant committed those acts as testified to by the victim, but did not intend them. And I'll just leave it at that. But turning to appellant's second point of error, the trial court properly instructed the jury on the duration element of CSA. Now, a jury charge which tracks the language of a particular statute is a proper charge on that statutory issue, as the Court of Criminal Appeals said in Martinez versus State. Now, Ms. Mullen argues that grammatically speaking, there's an issue that could cause confusion in this particular case. And yes, it does include language that's not included in the statute.
So does it really track the statute if it includes an extra comma and some other information that's not in the statute itself?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is simply we have to allege the time period that's alleged in the indictment and the jury charge. It has to be in there. But when you actually read the language of the statute or the language of the jury charge, it says during a period of time that is 30 days or more in duration, comma, on or about the 12th day of June 2012 through the 16th day of April 2017, did commit two or more acts of sexual abuse, and then it lists the underlying acts. That phrase that Ms. Mullen has mentioned, alleging the time frame, it's simply an interruptory phrase that's interrupting the flow of the sentence with commas. That could just, grammatically speaking, that could just as well be removed. And the jury could see, yes, during the period of time that is 30 days or more in duration, did commit two or more acts of sexual abuse. It's literally accurate. And if the jury was confused about it, there probably would have been some indication. Like, for example, they might have put a jury note or something, or at least their deliberations would have lasted more than 35 minutes. So I don't think that this statute is as confusing as the appellant makes it out to be. She did mention one case in which similar language was struck down. I believe the case she was talking about was Turner v. State from the Amarillo Court of Appeals. The problem with that case is it specifically addresses the issue of whether it tracks the statutory language. And in that case, the court said, yes, the court's charge tracks the statutory language, but because the statute's not clear, we're going to hold that it's error anyway. The problem with that is it's in direct contravention to their Court of Criminal Appeals precedent that says if it tracks the statutory language, it's okay. Now, as far as the other case that she mentioned, that case actually tied the duration requirement of continuous sex abuse to the allegations. So the language in that particular jury charge was, if you find that on or about the first day of December 2007 through the first day of September 2008, which said time period being a period that was 30 days or more in duration. So it specifically said, this allegation already satisfies this requirement. So you don't need to find anything else as far as time period. We already have that in the allegation. So that was clearly error. And if that was our jury charge, we would be conceding that. But that's not the jury charge we have today. Now, the jury charge, even if there was error in it, it was not egregiously harmful. Even the cases that hold that there was error in the duration requirement of the jury charge, that every single one of them hold that there was no egregious error. And they do that by looking at the normal things the courts look at to find harm, the arguments of the jury, whether the requirement was explained elsewhere. Here it was explained elsewhere during voir dire. The prosecutor explained the 30-day requirement to the jury. Again, the jury was not confused because they only deliberated for 35 minutes with no additional jury notes.
Well, you'll concede, though, that, I mean, a jury can deliberate really quickly because they get misinformation, too. I mean, if there's a charge that is blatantly wrong, it could cause a jury to deliberate fast because they've been given the wrong information. And so it's an argument, but it's not fully, you know, it's not a 100% winner, what you're saying. You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that in certain contexts, if the jury charge is in error, it could definitely quickly mislead a jury. However, I don't think that's this case. If the court were to find error, it's at best a little bit confusing, but I would not say that it's outright misleading. I don't think the jury could look at that and say, oh yeah, definitely the 30-day requirement is satisfied just from the language of that charge, and so I can't find that. That's not the case we have before.
Or rise to the level of egregious harm.
Correct. Now, turning to appellant's third point of error, appellant wishes to revive a tired argument that's been consistently dismissed and rejected by this court and her sister courts by citing this new Supreme Court precedent that it's frankly irrelevant. The Supreme Court has consistently held that in issues about what parts of a crime are elements and what are not elements of the crime that the jury has to be unanimous about are made by the legislature, and they're limited only by due process under the 14th Amendment. It has nothing to do with Sixth Amendment jury unanimity. And the Ramos Court specifically held that the Sixth Amendment jury unanimity requirement applies to the states. And they specifically called out two states, the only two states in the country that did not at the time require a unanimous jury. That was Louisiana and Oregon. Texas has long required that juries be unanimous about the underlying, about criminal offenses. And the jury was unanimous in this case. That was also in the jury charge. As for which specific parts of the crime the jury needs to be unanimous about, this court has already mentioned the other cases that the appellant cites in her brief, and those cases have already adequately been distinguished by this court's sister courts, so I don't think I need to belabor the point. With that, unless the court has any additional questions about these issues or any others, the state will rest on its brief.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I wanted to touch on point five, unless the court had questions about the other ones. It's the admission of the judge of an unfounded extraneous abuse allegation under the theory that the defense had opened the door. And I argue that it was completely and wholly inadmissible and highly prejudicial. The way it happened was that the complainant was testifying, and there had been about a year, maybe 2 years earlier, the niece, who also had testified, but she was not questioned in any regard about this, the niece had made a report to CPS of sexual abuse. CPS had talked to the complainant 2 years, maybe a year earlier, and questioned her about the abuse. She had denied that allegation, said it didn't happen, and the case was closed, it was unfounded. Also, during the course of that, apparently there were some statements made where the niece also said she was abused by the defendant. That's going to be where the extraneous conduct comes in that's highly prejudicial in this particular case. Another link in the chain to a 30-minute verdict. So when the complainant testifies, the defense attorney on cross-examination, which I think any good defense attorney would do, is asked her questions about previously she was asked by CPS about abuse, and she denied it, that there was not abuse. In result of that, the state then offered the fact that they needed to explain why CPS had talked to her 2 years earlier. My argument is, first of all, the relevance and importance of that is negligible. What is that relevant to? Who cares why she was talking to CPS, first of all? Second of all, they believe they were entitled to go into that it was the type of abuse that wasn't this type of abuse. That might be a viable argument. But then what they did in front of the jury and were allowed to by the court is introduce not only that the niece had told that the complainant had been abused, but that she had been abused in her complaint to CPS 2 years before to rebut the defense's questioning as of simply, you denied sexual abuse 2 years earlier to CPS. Now, how that is any way relevant, any way probative or rebuts that cross-examination by the defense attorney is beyond me. That is highly prejudicial in a case that has no direct evidence, no physical evidence, no physical evidence on the complainant, no DNA, no physical evidence on the sheets, bedding, fibers, solely her statement, which can be sufficient, I totally understand. But that's when you get down to cases like this, is where an extraneous allegation by a niece who's already testified and is not even saying it happened at the time of this trial, brought in to rebut questions of, you never said you were abused before, cannot be allowed. Highly prejudicial, and was used in front of the jury to show not only was there an allegation that he abused this complainant, but the niece who had already testified and never mentioned it as well. So that alone, in my opinion, requires a reversal of this particular case, and the harm of that is very clear given the facts.
Can you articulate the harm for me, given the strength of the evidence in this particular case?
Yes. from looking at the evidence, like I was saying, there's no physical evidence to actually prove the case. It's all...
But that's awful.
A lot of times it is, a lot of times it's not, but I agree with you. That's enough and that's sufficient for a conviction. But it also makes it a closer call for a jury that's looking at evidence. There was inconsistencies in her testimony. I always hate to do this part because it's like I'm coming down on a complainant. I'm not. Just looking at it legally, logistically, it makes it a weaker case for a jury to look at. The niece also had testified earlier, so that then shores up even her testimony and credibility, backs up the credibility, and now we've got another victim, two victims of sexual abuse, and I can't imagine a jury in the world that wouldn't take that to heart, that wouldn't believe, make that allegation of the original complainant more believable and more apt to convict based on that, not necessarily the evidence in the case.
You think that was the nudge?
I do, personally, from reading the record, from the actual record of the case.
And if we were to just overturn this case based on this alone, then would you agree that reversing and remanding would be the appropriate remedy so that another trial could ensue that where this isn't allowed?
Yes, just on this case,
just
on
this
ground?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. And this... tell me again, this is where they actually asserted that the state asserted that he opened the door?
Correct.
With his questioning?
Yes.
Yeah. And
you could read the language. Read the language. I mean, it's very clear in the record that he was asking for sure what I would ask. You know, you denied a claim of abuse in the past. So I don't care how they want to phrase it, there's no way that opens a door to another extraneous victim, in my legal opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counselors, we appreciate your argument today. It's been very helpful to us. Your case has been submitted now, and you are free to go about your business. Thank you.